From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. 2 years ago, wildfires chewed up nearly 2 million acres in California. Last year, just under 300,000. Still a lot, but much better than before. A look at why we weren't as scorched in 2019. Plus, cops have long relied on radios to communicate with each other, but there was a time when the LAPD used radio shows to connect with the public. It's all coming up on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Ian Martinez. So glad you could make us part of your lovely Thursday afternoon because, lucky for you, we have a great show coming right up. There's a story of how the LAPD once had its own show decades before Cops.
Your Los Angeles police are on the air.
We have the history about the department's own radio show back in the 1940s and 50s, plus how LA's historic Filipino town came to be and what happens when the neighborhood changes as fewer Filipinos call it home and it's renamed Hi-Fi. Those stories coming up starting in about half an hour. First, though, we're going to talk wildfires. Back in 2018, California endured the most destructive wildfire year on record, a total of 1.8 million acres burned statewide. And 2019 could have been just as disastrous. The number of ignitions, as in those first few sparks of the blaze, they went up. But instead, just 270,000 acres burned. Now, that's still a lot. That's the smallest number, though, recorded since 2011. To find out what happened and what we can do to repeat those numbers, or maybe even do better this year, we have Bettina Boxall, who covers the environment for the LA Times. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
Now, that drop is dramatic compared to what we've been through. Can you give us a more detailed walkthrough of those numbers?
So this is the total acreage burned in 2019, which was far less than the, you know, 1.8 million or the 1.3 million in 2017. It was not a matter of fewer ignitions. There were actually more ignitions in 2019 than there were in 2018. And it's not the number of ignitions that determines a bad wildfire year or a bad wildfire season. The key things are the amount of acreage burned, the destruction, and the fatalities. And by every measure, 2019 was a comparatively mild fire season, and certainly tamer than was predicted by CAL FIRE at the beginning of the year, when they were saying because the previous winter had been wet, therefore there was a big crop of grass which would dry and be, you know, fuel for fires. And so they were actually predicting that 2019 would be another bad wildfire year, and it didn't turn out that way.
When it comes to those ignitions, that increase in ignitions, maybe climate change leading to dry vegetation?
It's not climate change that is increasing the ignitions. Climate change, you know, makes for drier, warmer conditions, which, you know, are conducive to wildfire. But the 20 most destructive wildfires on record in California, they're all human related. It's either people directly or indirectly, their equipment, power lines, electrical malfunctions. And if you look at the 10 most destructive wildfires in California, they're all wind driven. So it's a matter of timing, really. When you have a matchup of those ignitions during extreme fire weather and extreme windy conditions.
The worst possible double whammy, right?
That's the winds, right. That's
right. Yeah. What about rain, water? It was kind of wet last year. Did that play into it?
If you talk to firefighters, well, they say two things about the previous wet winter. On the one hand, it produced a big crop of grass, which, you know, dries and is more fuel. On the other hand, it was a unusually wet spring last year and a big snowpack. And so that meant that the vegetation in wildlands didn't dry out as early as it usually does. And after the disastrous 2018, they were also quicker to order, you know, extensive evacuations. And I think people heeded them to a greater degree than they might have in the past because of what happened in Paradise in 2018. So those were all factors, but the biggest factor was arguably the extensive power shutdowns that PG&E imposed in November and October.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, like manipulating technology or actually maybe even include the tracking systems too.
So what PG&E started to do last year, because of, you know, the enormous liability that they had incurred with power line fires that were caused in the past couple of years, they just, you know, shut down power distribution for huge parts of Northern California.
Large swaths.
So millions, yeah. millions of Northern Californians were without power for days, in the fall, in October and November. And these were controversial. They were very disruptive. But after the shutdowns, PG&E inspected their equipment and their transmission lines and their distribution lines, and they found more than 300 instances of wind damage to their equipment or power lines, and said that in more than 200 cases, that damage would have been sufficient to cause electrical arcing, which of course can, you know, cause sparks. And so I think there's a strong argument to be made that those power shutdowns, as disruptive as they are, prevented wildfires during these high wind events that would have been caused by damaged power lines.
So they'll continue. That's the sense I'm getting, is that they're going to keep doing them.
Yes, PG&E is going to continue to do that. I mean, you know, they were subject to massive criticism because they were so widespread, and, you know, criticism that they were unnecessarily big. And I would imagine they will try to narrow them. But they have said that, yes, we plan to continue to do this.
We're talking to Bettina Boxall, who covers the environment for the LA Times. Now, going forward, it looks like California is going to have to take significant preventative steps to keep ignitions at a minimum. What next steps might the state take? And what will this look like for us here in California?
Well, California actually does less than some of our neighboring regions in trying to prevent human ignitions during the worst times, you know, during red flag days and extreme winds. For instance, I talked to fire managers for a national forest in New Mexico, the Cibolo. In 7 of the past 10 years, they have closed significant portions of their forest to public access during the peak wildfire season to prevent human ignitions. And this is something that region of the Forest Service is much more likely to do than the California region of the Forest Service.
Why not? Why wouldn't we do that here?
Because it's politically unpopular, because there is public blowback about, you know, why are you closing our forests? And, you know, we want access. And that doesn't seem to be the case in New Mexico and Arizona, where the public is more attuned to, well, yes, it's better if we, you know, if we stay out of the forest, you know, during these few weeks so we don't start a massive wildfire. But I think, you know, there's an argument to be made that the sort of the human role in causing these big wildfire disasters has been somewhat overlooked. I mean, the emphasis has been on the role of climate change, and you know, more attention needs to be made to preventing, you know, these human ignitions. It doesn't matter how dry the vegetation is. It doesn't matter how strong the winds are. It doesn't matter how hot the temperature is. If there is no ignition, there is no wildfire. So if you prevent those human ignitions at the worst times, when the wind is blowing 70, 80 miles an hour, and it's single-digit humidity, and the vegetation is dried out, you know, particularly in the fall, then you prevent an out-of-control wildfire.
So it sounds like it's literally in our hands to prevent this.
Yes, this is something we can do something about, you know, much more quickly than climate change.
Yeah.
So humans are playing a huge role in driving these, you know, the increase in wildfire and the, you know, the catastrophic wildfires that are taking such a toll. So we can do something about that.
That's Bettina Boxall, covers the environment for the LA Times. Bettina, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
While those power shutoffs by Pacific Gas and Electric may have minimized ignitions last year, they did have some unintended consequences. Cell towers lost power. In one instance, on October 27th, 874 towers went offline in an area, and that affected millions of Californians. They might not have been able to make calls to emergency services or maybe not receive evacuation alerts. So yesterday, state lawmakers introduced a bill that requires telecom companies to provide 72 hours of backup power to cell towers during shutoffs in fire-prone areas. Associated Press state government reporter Adam Beam joins us to talk about this. Adam, welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, now last year, PG&E cut power to millions of people to stop utility lines from sparking a fire. However, that also cut power to cell towers. Can you describe in more detail about what that meant for people living in those areas and how they were able to reach the outside world?
Well, sure. For many people, they were cut off from the outside world because it wasn't just cell towers. I mean, that was a big part of it. But, you know, a lot of people, their home phone lines were out because they're not on the copper wire. You know, the traditional landline copper wire phones are really disappearing across the state. Most people use the voice over internet protocol phones. And so when those lost power as well, they went out. And so people, not only could they not get any messages on their phone, but they couldn't even dial out from their landlines if they wanted to call 911 or reach a loved one or something.
Now, yesterday, representatives from AT&T and Verizon testified before the state legislature about the whole situation. What was their point of view on the shutoffs and the offline cell towers?
Well, their point of view is, look, you shouldn't be holding us accountable for the power company's decision to cut the power. I mean, state regulators are allowing them to de-energize, and yet you're expecting us to become the replacement power for the grid. And they think that's unfair. They focused on the overall number. So if you look at all of the counties that the power was cut off for at one time, about 3% of the cell towers were out. So that looks like a pretty small number. But when you zero in and look at some of the individual counties, like in Marin County, it was more than half. It was almost 60%. So I think it was 57% of the towers were offline. That's a big problem, especially because Marin County was kind of a evacuation center for a lot of folks, too. So that when they got to Marin County, they couldn't use their phones.
How many people was that?
Well, I'm not sure how many people in total, because as the telecom companies pointed out, just because a tower goes out doesn't necessarily mean there's an outage for those people, because there are overlaps. So, you know, some towers that are close by might overlap that are still active. And plus, the telecom companies do bring in temporary towers, like sometimes they'll use for sporting events or something when there's a lot of people in one place. They'll bring in these temporary mobile things. So they did that to try to help boost some coverage. But it was in the millions of people for sure. But, you know, the other problem they had is, you know, a lot of them had backup generators, and a lot of them went out of state to prepare for this, to buy even more backup generators. But then when they tried to bring the backup generators into the state, they couldn't because the trucks that were delivering them did not meet California's emission standards, so they couldn't cross the border. So then they had to scramble to try to get waivers, emergency waivers, to get those generators in place. And plus, once they got the generators to the towers, they found it was harder than they expected to keep them fueled, because you had a lot of towers, all these generators take diesel fuel. It's a big effort logistically to try to make sure that they're all operating and have the amount of fuel that they need.
We're talking to the Associated Press's state government reporter, Adam Beam. Now, as we mentioned, there's a new bill to make telecom companies provide all cell towers in fire-prone areas with 72 hours of backup power, and that's by State Senator Mike McGuire. What would a company have to do to make that happen?
Well, they would have to either install a permanent, like, on-site generator, or they would have to have some mobile generators ready to deploy, because not all cell towers are in an area where on-site power generation is feasible. And it would cost a lot of money for them to do this. And historically, the industry has fought this. The Federal Communications Commission tried to require this back after Hurricane Katrina, 2005. There was a lot of outages around New Orleans for that devastating hurricane. They had a regulation that went in place, and the industry took them to court. And eventually, the White House Office of Management and Budget rejected the rule, and so the rule kind of went away. So the industry has fought this successfully in the past, and I'm pretty sure they're going to be trying to fight this going forward.
Now, last year, California did successfully pass a law to manage telecom companies. They're now required to report large service outages to the state within the hour. Have we seen that in action yet?
No, we haven't, because just because they pass a law doesn't mean it goes into effect. I mean, they have to come up with, exactly how are they going to report it, and who are they going to report it to, and what type of information, how would they present the data to the state officials? All of that is being developed right now at the state regulatory level. The Office of Emergency Services, they've put out a draft regulations, and then you have to have public comment on it. So all that is still in the process. And yesterday, the president of the Public Utilities Commission had some really strong criticism for the telecom companies, saying that she felt like they did not show up. They weren't present during the Kincaid fire and then during the other power shutoff events from last fall, and that they weren't providing information. And they feel like that these rules need to be strengthened, maybe even more beyond what is already in law.
That's the Associated Press state government reporter, Adam Beam. Adam, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You know, over the past few years, California wildfires have destroyed whole towns, farms, wineries, you name it. Flames have touched it or either threatened it. But California is a really big state, and there are large swaths of land devoted to one specific industry. California has more of these than any other state in the United States, and fires have been a huge threat to those spots as well. And they house billions and billions of dollars worth of equipment. Find out what they are when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Even though last year wasn't as bad for California in wildfires, climate change is still making wildfires worse around the world. Hotter temperatures, drier conditions, and unusual rain patterns all mean that vegetation is more likely to burn. It's a danger not only to communities, but on military bases as well, leading the Pentagon to declare fires and other effects of climate change a national security problem. For Southern California's military bases in particular, it's a pressing issue. KPCC's Jacob Margolis reports from Santa Barbara.
September 19th, 2016. The canyon wildfire is burning through the dry, rolling hills of Vandenberg Air Force Base, crispy after years of record-setting drought and high temperatures. It's out of control. Day turns to night as firefighters are surrounded by smoke and flames. Their body cameras catch the sounds of their retreat.
Let's go! Let's go!
The fire started 2 days earlier in a remote part of the 100,000-acre Air Force Base. Chief Mark Farias is a 20-year veteran of the Vandenberg Fire Department.
It's kind of like a military battle, right? You need the ground troops, which we call, let's call them hot shots. You need the tanks, which we'll call the fire trucks, and you need air support. So that unholy trinity is what we typically need for almost every fire.
Fighting fires on military bases can be complicated. There's ordnance and chemical storage and buildings crucial to national security. At Vandenberg at the time, one of the biggest issues was a little over a mile away, a Delta II rocket ready to launch.
Having a rocket fully loaded on a pad, fully fueled, that's a pucker factor, you know, and having fire all around the area and threatening the facility.
The Department of Defense is concerned that wildfires are becoming an increasing threat to many facilities, driven by extreme weather conditions that are getting worse as the climate changes. A 2019 DOD report on the effects of a changing climate dedicated a section to the wildfire threat, wonkily pointing out, climatic factors, including increased wind and drought, can lead to an increased severity of wildfire activity. Maureen Sullivan is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Environment.
You know, we just had a huge fire this summer up in Alaska, which was really problematic. So you wouldn't think, you know, of Alaska as a wildfire risk, but that tells you how the wildfire situation is changing.
The Pentagon report looked at 72 bases. It said that half of those could be threatened by wildfire, and that number is expected to grow. The report urges installations to plan ahead.
They have to take into consideration a changing climate, but how do they go about it?
Sullivan said that the Defense Department is trying to help them. For instance, it developed a tool that can help bases figure out what might burn, where that fire might spread, and how they could respond. There's also a new climate adaptation tool that's supposed to help facilities figure out the scope of different kinds of climate threats. Though there are practical things that the bases are doing right now. Clearing vegetation is a big one, especially with controlled burns, though some bases are limited by local laws. They're also partnering with local, state, and national fire agencies. Actually, that's what saved Chief Farias at Vandenberg when the fire was burning out of control back in 2016.
What was the turning point where you guys were able to finally...
Getting enough air resources and enough hotshot crews.
The Vandenberg fire burned only 12,500 acres, relatively reasonable for a California fire. But Chief Farias says it shows why his base needs better brush management, more people, and more money.
I mean, we haven't gained resources, even though our launch tempo is more, even though it's drier, even though things have gotten worse, we're actually less people, less resourced. And so that has an impact. You know, that means that things are going to get worse before they get better sometime, you know.
Like other folks in California and much of the country, he knows that the next big fire could be right around the corner. I'm Jacob Margolis in Los Angeles.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We turn now to education because in California, fewer than 10% of teachers are men of color. And that's a problem because they could play a significant role in helping to close the achievement gap for black and brown boys. As part of our California Dream collaboration, KQED's Vanessa Rancagno reports.
Today in third period, English teacher Daryl McKellar has a writing assignment for his ninth grade students.
So this is what I'm asking you guys to do. What does racism mean to you? How is racism related to the apartheid that's discussed in the text?
They seem sorta, kinda interested, but some phones are out.
How many people have experienced, let's do it this way. You've experienced something. Because you're black or brown, you've experienced something.
Hands go up around the room. All the students in this veteran teacher's classroom in South Central LA are black or Latino.
What you got, Jaquan?
Jaquan says 2 days ago, he was at a store in Santa Monica.
They were just following me around, like keeping a close eye on me, seeing if I was going to steal something.
McKellar tells the students about a time in college when a classmate made a racist comment about him.
I could have flipped out, but for what? Because if I flip out, then what? I get kicked out of class. Can't graduate, then you would never have me in front of you.
He gets a smile out of the students. They keep their eyes on him.
And I don't want you guys to be part of that, oh, well, you know, I'm black, I'm brown, I ain't gonna make it, I go to school in the hood. I call BS on that. Do not make your life hard.
McKellar's ability to connect with his students, to relate to and understand their experiences, makes a difference. When students of color have teachers of color in classrooms like this one, there's strong evidence they learn more, finish high school at higher rates, and are more likely to aspire to college.
When you see someone in front of you that looks like you, and you can relate to what they're talking about, and they can code switch and come to where you're at, and then come back out and say, like, see, I just jumped somewhere else, but I was just there with you. So what does that mean that you need to do? And I say, I gotta jump with you. So
for almost my whole school year life, I only had, like, woman teachers.
Student Elijah Foster says having a teacher like McKellar is still a pretty new experience. His classmate Tyler Banner says it's just different.
It feels like the man expects more out of you.
See him as like the homie, like a close friend, like as in like trustable.
McKellar knows he can play a critical role for his students. That's why he's sharing his 20 years experience in the classroom with aspiring male teachers of color. He's part of a program at a handful of California State University teachers' colleges that could be a model for getting more men of color into teaching.
You know, because sometimes we could sit in a classroom and it's 25 young ladies and it's only like three of us.
28-year-old Fabian Flores is in the Future Minority Male Teachers of California program. He says he almost quit early on after a veteran teacher warned him away from the profession, saying it's underpaid, undervalued.
I was kind of like on the ropes, like, yeah, should I continue? Yes, no. Man, I don't really belong even.
He says having McKellar's guidance and a support group of other men of color gave him the confidence to believe that not only does he belong, he's really needed. But he had another problem. He was scrambling to pay for school. And that's not unusual, especially for students of color, who are disproportionately burdened by debt. The program offered Flores a $5,000 scholarship.
I would not be here if it wasn't for that extra money.
Now for him, it's a matter of overcoming his own doubts about what comes next.
What scares me is getting a job in elementary school where I don't have a mentor that shows me the ropes.
Dominguez Hills is trying to make sure students like Flores stay on track to finish and move into classrooms as full-fledged teachers. The next challenge is actually keeping them there. In Los Angeles, I'm Vanessa Rancagno.
We're going to hear more from Vanessa about a strategy that's helping keep men of color teaching once they're in the classroom. That's coming up in just a few minutes. Also, LA's diversity is one of the reasons why it's such a great place to live. City has a lot of neighborhoods highlighting that. And today we're going to hear about historic Filipino Town, a place that's really changed a lot over the years, so much so that Filipinos really hardly live there anymore. But should that matter? We're going to get into that coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Got a lot more news all afternoon here on KPCC. Nick Roman is the host of All Things Considered. Nick, what do you got coming up today?
Well, we got a lot of news about LA's St. Vincent Medical Center. It's set to enter bankruptcy and close, and KPCC's Robert Garoba will look into what shutting down a hospital means for the people who work there, who are treated there, for the Westlake community where St. Vincent is. There's also a debate about how to handle coyotes in the city of Walnut. And it got us thinking about people and coyotes in urban Southern California. So we're going to talk with a National Park Service biologist about how coyotes and people can coexist. And, of course, you know, you say goodbye to the Red Line and hello, B Line. Metro unveiled its new letter naming system for bus and train lines. One letter is missing. Go down the alphabet. You'll know what it is. And we'll break it all down with KPCC and LAists Ryan Fonseca. Now, if it had been me, they would have called them the Koufax line,
the Worthy line, and the Magic line. I got to say, I'm honored that Metro decided to honor me with the A line. I don't know what I did to Well, maybe years of great radio. Maybe that's it. Nick Roman, that's it. ATC coming up. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. The number of teachers of color in California is not keeping pace with the number of black and brown students in our classrooms. And one problem is that too many of these teachers leave the profession. For the second part of her story, KQED's Vanessa Rancagno takes us to meet a group of men trying to find a solution.
Daryl McKellar makes teaching look easy. Over 20 years in the classroom, the Los Angeles English teacher has mastered some of the job's trickiest tasks.
Title story? Lottery. And what am I asking you guys
right now? How to get students to connect to the texts he teaches.
Sabrina, what do you know? When I say lottery, what do you think? Automatic. Money. Brianna, what do you think?
Drama.
Why drama? More money, more problems. Who said it? It is a rapper.
And how to crack his students up.
More money, more problem. Wait, Baby, baby. Notorious B.I.G. But he also says we can't expect to change the world until we do what? Change who? Change yourself. Very good. So
let the record show that students are engaged.
Just 1% of teachers in California are black men like McKellar. That's why he works with a local teachers' college to help train others. But just preparing them for the classroom isn't enough to keep them there.
A lot of teachers don't stay, especially young black, young brown teachers don't choose to stay because they don't feel supported.
Poor working conditions are the thing most likely to drive any teacher from the profession. But teachers of color are concentrated in schools with the most challenging conditions. That's a big part of the reason they leave at higher rates, and black and brown men are especially likely to quit. Longtime Compton Unified teacher Marco Godinez has some thoughts on why.
The only time I ever seem to get a phone call is, hey, we've got these kids misbehaving in this class. Can you come over and help them calm down? And we're not respected at the same level as other teachers. We're just seen as discipline experts.
A few school districts around the country are creating support networks specifically for male teachers of color, places to learn from peers and share expertise. But at Godinez's school in Compton, they're trying something a little different. School leadership is working side by side with its male teachers of color.
Good morning, good morning. Welcome back to our Compton Male Teacher of Color Network meeting.
On a Saturday at Dominguez High School in Compton, a dozen teachers are gathered in the library. The principal is here, the assistant principal, even the district superintendent. Laptops are out around the table. One teacher is busy trying to wrangle his toddlers. There are bagels and coffee, Google Docs, and a projector. The teachers paired up and visited each other's classrooms recently.
What I noticed in Mr. Rogini, he's saying, don't worry about the mistakes. It's okay to make mistakes.
They spent some time sharing strategies they discovered.
I think I kind of put the kids a little bit more defensive. I need to empathize with the students more.
Then they turned to something else. There'd been a lockdown on campus a day earlier after a student made a violent threat.
Our kids don't know how to react to that trauma because they're kids. They're kids. It's like we have to model that.
Principal Blaine Watson is listening intently. He chimes in.
I've literally woken up in the middle of the night thinking about kids here at school. Like, are they okay?
For the teachers, seeing their principal be so vulnerable humanizes him, helps them trust him.
I don't know how to deal with that.
This is also a place where he seeks their advice. It's changed the power dynamic on campus. Watson has given teachers more space to shape decisions. In turn, Godinez and other teachers have stepped into leadership roles.
For me, this is the first time that I've felt like we're getting down to the actual issues that are plaguing this school, and we're finally getting down to real solutions.
The teachers in this room feel listened to and needed. And that could be the thing that keeps them in the classroom. In Compton, I'm Vanessa Rancagno.
Let's go from changing classrooms to changing neighborhoods. Just on the other side of the 101 from Echo Park is a small rectangular neighborhood, historic Filipino town. It's bounded by Beverly Boulevard to the south, Glendale Boulevard to the east, and Benton Way to the west. It's one of the most recent ethnic enclaves in Los Angeles, only getting an official designation in 2002. But how it came to be and how it's evolving into something for younger generations called hi-fi is the subject of a two-part series by LA Times columnist Frank Xiong. The first part is out now, and he joins us now to talk about it. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, eh?
Historic Filipino town. What was shifting there that got your attention?
So I used to live in East Hollywood and drive along Temple Boulevard to work at the old offices of the LA Times. And so I'd always drive through historic Filipino town. And so I used to check the Snapchat location geofilters for everywhere. And I first started seeing hi-fi in this really interesting illustrated image in my Snapchat location filter. And that was the first thing I had heard about the community. I remember Googling it and I saw nothing.
Now, as you document, this neighborhood was one of the landing grounds for Filipino immigrants starting in the 50s. But when and why did this start to coalesce into something maybe that felt more like a true community?
It all has to do with immigration. You know, I think ethnic enclaves are all enlivened by immigration flows. And so in the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of Filipino immigration to the United States because of the Hart-Celler Act and immigration quotas were lifted. And so a lot of Filipinos began to settle in a lot of places around Los Angeles. And historic Filipino town was always one of those places.
And when community leaders try to lobby in the interest and in to try and get this designated, what reasons would they want to do that for?
Well, I think having an enclave provides a focal point for acquiring political influence in Los Angeles. You know, it gives you a place to host events. And so in some ways, it's just part of the optics. You know, it gives people a shortcut into city government and it gives politicians a shortcut in appealing to those communities. So getting a Filipino town or any other type of enclave or official designation is usually an attempt to acquire more political power as well as sort of organize and draw economic investment to the area.
Who was leading those efforts for historic Filipino town back then?
You know, there have been a bunch of different efforts to start a historic Filipino town. There's one in the 70s that started with a group of Filipino investors who mainly focused on building a business district. Pretty much with every councilman that has represented that area since the 70s and 80s, people have tried and failed. And so it was only Garcetti, I believe, was running against Michael Wu. Appealing to the Filipino community became something that made a lot of political sense. There was a lot of Filipinos around in Los Angeles. It was an extremely numerous vote. As part of his promises, Garcetti promised that historic Filipino town would be designated if he was elected, and he did so.
Talking to Frank Xiong, LA Times columnist, about the origins of historic Filipino town. Now, all right, we mentioned 2002, then City Councilman Eric Garcetti sponsored the bill to make a historic Filipino town happen, but it was a double-edged sword, right, to some who were behind the effort in the first place. Why?
It's a sort of complicated process that I'm still trying to write about, but George Villanueva, who was the Filipino-American field deputy representing that area for Eric Garcetti's office during that time, you know, he wrote a paper essentially describing some regrets. He was concerned that designating the community would also make it a target for investment. And that was simply because of the nature of what they were doing. They were putting a name on a place. They were giving a place an opportunity to become a brand. And once you create a brand, it's not up to you to control it. And I think what he's finding now, and when he goes back and sees what's in Filipino town now and what's happening to it, he's just finding that it turned out much differently than he had hoped. You know, a lot of his paper talks about how low-income residents and people of color and the people that the designation and his engagement efforts were designed for don't seem to be the ones benefiting 20 years on.
And when it comes to the life and soul of neighborhoods, I mean, we've seen it over the years all over L.A. They naturally ebb and flow. And today's historic Filipino town doesn't really have the same concentration of Filipinos as it once had. Where did people go?
Well, there are Filipino enclaves in Eagle Rock, in Carson, in West Covina, in the San Fernando Valley, in Long Beach, and in various places around Los Angeles, you know. And so those places do exist. Historic Filipino town, I guess, has a lot of historical relevance as sort of the landing ground where it all sort of began.
I was looking at statistics that show just about a third of the population in historic Filipino town identify as Asian. Latinos make up more than half of the people who live there. I'm wondering, Frank, in the grand scheme of things, when it comes to a neighborhood like historic Filipino town, how much does that matter?
You know, I don't think it does. It's strange to me that part of the value of ethnic communities should be the proportion of that ethnicity who live there. These names, just like all of the names in the city of Los Angeles, exist to honor certain historical facts or serve certain political interests. And a name is just a name, you know, a designation is just a designation. But the community that's there, I believe it's always been part Filipino, part Latino, also Black, also Chinese, also Japanese. There's always been an incredible mix of diversity there. So what I would hope to do with the column and with this series is try to reframe the conversation, not about what the name and our expectations of it are, but to the community and what's actually there.
All right, Frank, the first part of two is out now. Next week, you'll write about changes coming to the neighborhood. But for a preview, one of those changes is its name. Now, some have given historic Filipino town the nickname Hi-Fi. As you mentioned, it showed up digitally for you. That's kind of how you noticed it. What does that signal, you think, about the soul of the neighborhood now?
One of the things I hope to get into in the second piece is to kind of identify exactly what upsets people about this community change, about gentrification. When a neighborhood gets a new name, it definitely means that things are changing, you know, but names are something that everyone can participate in. And in historic Filipino town, you do find locals like John Eric Concordia of Park's Finest and Justin Feronda of Hi-Fi Kitchen kind of participating in the creation of what the neighborhood will become. And that means there is some connection to the past. There is some connection to the present and what's currently in that community.
Now, there are many ethnic enclaves like historic Filipino town all throughout Southern California. But I'm wondering what your takeaway is on how permanent they are and if they can stay true to their foundings when maybe it's the goal of the first inhabitants that their children find better lives for themselves somewhere else.
It's a complicated question. When you talk to the people in those communities, you know, they are glad that their children have found bigger jobs, bigger houses, in bigger cities. You know, this to them is progress. You know, it's just that what you see online and when you follow the conversation about the changes in those communities, you don't hear a celebration. You hear ambivalence. And so I guess what I wanted to do is try to unpack that ambivalence, you know, because if this is progress, you know, why does it feel like so much is being lost? Why does everyone mourn what has happened?
That's Frank Xiong, LA Times columnist. Frank, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me, eh?
In the immortal words of Inner Circle, bad boys, what you gonna do when they come for you? That's also the theme song of a very popular show called Cops, still on the air, has been on the air a long time. Our cops here in LA had their own show as well. It was on the radio, and they did it to communicate with the public on all kinds of things. Find out what kind of things they used to broadcast back in the 40s and 50s when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. All right, let me set the scene for you here. It's May 1950 in the City of Angels, Los Angeles, California. You just got home from a long day at work, so you flip on the radio to relax and unwind, and you hear this.
Your Los Angeles police are on the air. Through the cooperation of Warner Brothers radio station KFWB, the Los Angeles Police Department presents On the Beat, a half-hour radio show featuring music by the Los Angeles Police Band under the direction of Officer J. Edmund Burr. I'm Officer Cliff Bailey, who will walk with you on the beat.
That's right. In the late 1940s and early 50s, the LAPD used a series of radio programs for recruitment and to promote public awareness. And that is the subject of today's Throwback Thursday.
California, land of romance.
There is probably no single area holding so much of charm and beauty and the good things of life as Southern California.
Once a sleepy ranch town, now home to the stars of Tinseltown, the captains of industry and over 1 million men, women, and children.
There are boys and girls from the large cities and small towns. Each brings his dreams, his hopes, and his ambitions.
Mike Holland is the Los Angeles City Archivist. He's with us to talk about these LAPD radio shows. Mike, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, well, you heard a clip at the top there, but give us some more insight into these programs. Who was on them and what kinds of content did it feature?
So LAPD had a series of public service radio shows that they did. The most popular one was called On the Beat.
On the Beat.
It was aired out of the KFWB studio, and your host was Officer Cliff Bailey, who was a member of the Public Relations Department of LAPD. Mm. And the show had two purposes. It featured band music, band marches and things like that, as played by the LAPD police band. Now, this was a professional band. I mean, you would see them marching in parades. They used to do the Rose Parade here in Pasadena. They would do all sorts of fundraisers and events like that. And it's actually still active today.
Oh, wow.
Probably not as active, but they're still very much around today. And so in addition to band music, they would have interview segments either on some sort of public awareness element. They would also have other officer-type interviews. They had one gentleman who had been a police officer from 1904 to 1924. And so he recounted a story where some guy with dynamite tried to blow up the police headquarters in 1912. There was an interview with someone for missing persons, and they talking about the work that they do and
so
how
this
that
is sounding
kind of
like
thing.
Really interesting stuff, though. I mean, It's way back, but it sounds like stuff I'd listen to today.
Well, it's probably more interesting today to look at as an artifact of its time. But at the time, these programs were more for public service and not necessarily for entertainment.
But why did they start them up? Why did the LAPD even start them up to begin with? Was it to control their image or control public perception?
That's entirely possible, because keeping in mind that up until the late 1940s, LAPD had the unflattering distinction of probably being one of the most corrupt departments in the country. And so anything that could resurrect their image a little bit was certainly something that they would welcome. Now, when Bill Parker became police chief in 1950, one of the things that he instituted right away is a much stricter discipline among LAPD officers. And so they needed as much help as they could get in the media.
Now, Mike, you call them public service announcements, so to speak. Mm-hmm. They also took the opportunity to educate the audience. So let's listen to a snippet from a 1947 show. It's a discussion between both fire and police departments about how the public should conduct themselves during a fire.
I believe the law states that it's not only illegal to follow a fire apparatus within 300 feet, but it's also illegal to park within 300 feet of a fire. Am I right?
Absolutely. Where police officers are on the job to prevent this from happening, we can work a great deal more efficiently. In fact, we have a 50-50 chance to put the fire out.
So, Mike, one example right there of the department taking advantage of educating their audience. So what were some other examples of that?
Well, in that same interview, they reported that there was a warehouse fire that 20 different people saw and no one bothered to call in. And so, which you wouldn't imagine that today, of course, because everyone's got a phone and everyone's calling in, you know, the drop of a hat. So they were doing those sorts of things to make, or I should say, persuade the public to be their eyes and ears in as many situations as they could, because being a police force stretched as tightly as they have always said they have been, they needed as many extra bodies out there to see things, call things in, and help them to the extent that that they can.
How is that, what you just mentioned, reflective of the culture at the time?
I mean, this is right after the Second World War, and so we're starting to get back to normal, whatever that was. But at the same time, we're also dealing with the Cold War. We're also dealing with the hunts for communists and the criminal element that is still very much in the air and around major cities. And so the public was basically being asked to be that extra set of eyes and ears for the police officer or the firefighter or the FBI agent or, pick your agency.
So the beginnings of if you see something, say something.
Absolutely.
In a way, yeah.
And there's a direct line between that kind of involvement to the campaigns that you see nowadays, whether it's for human trafficking, transit safety, it literally comes down to if you see something, say something.
Talking to Mike Holland, L.A. City Archivist, talking about the L.A. Police Department radio shows of the 40s and 50s. Now, on top of all that, there was also recruitment efforts for both men and women. Let's hear one of those commercials.
Hi, Mary.
Why, hello, Chuck.
You look like $1 million, Mary. Where have you been keeping yourself?
Well, you'd never guess. You're looking at a full-fledged member of the Los Angeles Police Department.
You, a policewoman?
Ladies of the law, we call them. It's fascinating work.
But do you make any money?
I should say we do. $260 a month to start.
Say, maybe that'd be a good job for my sister.
She can get full information at any police station. But tell her to hurry. It's the opportunity of a lifetime.
So, Mike, clearly that one targeted at women, but there were all kinds of these commercials airing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they were out to recruit women. They were certainly out to recruit veterans coming back from the World War II and later in Korea. They were out to fill the ranks with as many different kinds of people as they could. And they were still looking for minorities as well. But of course, there was still a lot of segregation going on at the time. And so they were hiring African-American police officers, African-American firefighters. They were just segregating them to a very specific police station or a very specific fire precinct. So they were, yes, they were recruiting across the spectrum of citizens, but where they were still allowed to pigeonhole them into specific tiny little communities, they would do.
But the radio aspect of it, Mike, because this is right before the television explodes all over the country. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that radio, I mean, everyone had a radio in their home, radios in cars, and LA was such a car culture. I can imagine that people really were paying a lot of attention to these radio shows by the LAPD.
I imagine they probably were. The problem with the format of On the Beat and the other ones that they tried was they were not interesting enough.
Ah.
They didn't have the sense of the dramatic. People wanted a little bit of drama in their, you know, their law enforcement diet.
Like a Dragnet style thing.
Dragnet was probably the breakout because it was so different from any of the other types of cop shows that had been around for probably 20 years at that point in time, all through the golden age of radio.
So ironically, these LAPD radio shows lacked the drama to have staying power?
I would say that was probably what did them in. They just weren't as interesting. Now, they told people what they needed to know, okay? But they didn't tell them anything they wanted to know. And I think that's the big difference.
That's Mike Holland, the Los Angeles City Archivist, here today talking about the LAPD radio shows of the 40s and 50s. Mike, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, finally, we end today's show by hopping aboard.
You must take the A train.
We aren't going to Harlem, but we are going to letters. LA's Metro Transit System has announced the final new names for all of its train lines, most of them currently named after colors like the Gold Line or the Red Line. Now they're going to have letters. Now, the Blue Line is already my favorite line, the A Line, for example. But now it's going to be joined by the likes of the B Line, which is the Red Line at the moment, and the Orange Line will become the G Line. New signs will be rolled out over the coming years, but those ABCs will be missing a few letters. No F Line, for example, says Metro's Rick Jagger.
Yeah, they had some concern with the letter F for obvious reasons in terms of slang.
But, well, some of our more dirtier-minded listeners pointed out that the purple line will become the D line. So you can ride the D train. Now, to that we say, get your mind out of the gutter. And if you need help figuring that out, ask your nearest millennial. That's going to do it for take two, maybe forever if the FCC heard that. You can always find us on social media. We're at Take Two, at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two, we'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.